Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for February the 12th, 2018. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David. Good evening, everybody. Yes, tonight we have our special guest is Brian Ellis. Brian is an Army veteran who will share his experience and insights about service in wartime. Brian served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Now his post-military work is helping veterans deal with and overcome obstacles as they transition from the military to civilian life. Brian devotes much of his time helping veterans recover from PTSD in the process of their transition into civilian life. But first, I'll remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And veterans, this is the Veterans News Hour. This is your show. So please call in and during the show, if you have any questions of Brian, specifically regarding PTSD, please call in. I'm sure Brian can add some insight into whatever question you may have. At this point, I'm going to turn it back over to David.
Thank you, Richard. It's my privilege to introduce our guest tonight, Brian Ellis. Brian is a member of the generation of Americans who heard the call to military service as a direct result of the terror attacks of September the 11th, 2001. Brian served in Iraq as a frontline infantryman during the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and after being injured in Iraq and then recovering from his injuries, he retrained to become a UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter crew chief in a newly formed medical evacuation unit. He then deployed to a forward operating base in northwest Afghanistan, where he flew over 50 medevac missions in his nine-month tour of duty. Brian returned home to the United States, and as he will tell you, had a difficult transition from war back to civilian life. Brian is our guest tonight to share with you his experiences and his insights as a combat veteran. He devotes his work now to helping other veterans recover from post-traumatic stress disorder and make a successful transition to civilian life. So without further ado, let's welcome Brian Ellis to the Veterans News Hour. How are you, Brian?
Good evening. I'm doing good. Thank you for having
Great.
Me on.
Yeah, we have a lot to discuss, so why don't we start, Brian, if you would tell us more about yourself, starting with your life before the military, and then how your life changed forever after the 9/11 attacks.
Okay. So, you know, from the beginning, I was your average guy. I'm from Michigan. My family moved down to Florida for work back in the early 90s. I've always had roots in the military. Most of my family have been military. I have a privilege of having a grandfather that was on a Missouri when the Japanese actually signed to surrender. But deep roots in the military, and I've always aspired to be in the military. I was a single dad, so I wasn't able to go in right after high school like I wanted to. But September 11th happened, and I really had to jump through some hoops and change my family care system around so I can join the military. I ended up joining the National Guard so I could at least be part of something.
I see. And then can you tell us, once you joined, that was the Florida National Guard, correct?
Yes, sir. That was the Florida Army National Guard, yes.
Right. And then could you tell us about your military training and then leading up to and including your first deployment, which was to Iraq?
Sure. So in 2002, I went to Fort Benning, Georgia. That's Army School of Infantry. I was in Bravo 258. I was a little older. I was 24 years old when I went through basic training. It was tough. It was for me, it was more emotionally tough because of I left my daughter behind, and I was physically ready for it, and I was mentally ready for the military, but the emotional toll it took on me from leaving my children behind, that was a little rough. Like most of us, though, you make it through, you gain a lot of confidence, a lot of esprit de corps, and you're really proud to be doing what you're doing. I was home. I graduated infantry school June 14th, 2002, and reported to my unit right after that. And then it was only a few months later, December 24th of 2002, we were activated for the deployment to Iraq.
Wow, what was your going through your mind at that point? Here you joined kind of in response to the 9/11 attacks. What was going through your mind whenever you hear that your unit, your guard unit, is being called up to invade Iraq? Any thoughts on that?
You know, that was an interesting story. I was actually at a Christmas party, believe it or not. I was enjoying myself at a Christmas party, and I got a phone call. It was my squad leader from my unit, and he told me that on December 26th, we had to report at the armory at 07 a.m. for a possible deployment. And we all had suspect that something was going to take place. I was under the initial impression that it could possibly be Kosovo. Kosovo was a big deal back in 2002, 2003 still. We get to the unit and we start preparing to mobilize. Things got real, really quick. We were on complete lockdown, couldn't go anywhere for a few days, and then they finally let us go back to our residence, secure our belongings, and make sure everything was set. By January 1, gentlemen, we were in Fort Stewart, Georgia, for the mobilization for Iraq. It happened that quick.
And tell us, Brian, tell us about that, because I'd like to have our listeners, as much as it's possible, kind of, from your perspective, what it was like. Here you joined the service, you'd gone through training, you'd gone back to Florida, and then you were called up, you know, for this invasion of Iraq. What's kind of going through your mind, and kind of walk us through what that was like, and tell us how you got over there, you know, what the journey was like, and just, you know, what you and the other troops were kind of going through and thinking.
Of course. So it was, you know, it's exciting. At the very beginning, it's very exciting. You know, there's an initial emotional response that takes place after things like September 11th. I mean, you know, you're kind of compelled to serve your country. And I think that's ingrained in us, especially as Americans. That's we've done that throughout history. And I have a sense of duty and obligation to duty. So that was a very emotional thing for me. So it was exciting. I don't want to say I was nervous, but I was, you know, of course, I was a young soldier. I just got out of infantry school, very prideful, a little arrogant, a little young, ready to go. I was ready to do my part. I was ready to kind of emulate the World War II vets that I had watched growing up on TV. I grew up watching Combat and Rat Patrol and other shows like that. So I was hoping it was going to be kind of that experience. That's what I was expecting. So there was a lot of excitement.
And how did you actually travel from the States over to, you know, walk us through your travels? Like, where you stopped and how the method of transport and that sort of thing, just so we can kind of be in your boots, so to speak, and get a sense of what it was like.
Right. So, like I said, around January 1st, we left for Fort Stewart, Georgia. We left the Florida Army National Guard Armory via bus. We bussed up to Fort Stewart. We had a pre-mobilization training regiment that we went through. Lasted, I want to say, almost 2 months. It was pretty, it was like base training over again, basically. I mean, we, you know, we had to qualify on all of our firearms all over again. We had to, you know, run through the gas chamber again, make sure that we knew how to don our chemical warfare equipment. We had to go through our, what they call COS training, which is your medical training. That way, if your buddy gets shot, you could bandage up his wound, things of that nature. And then we all took, we got the warning order saying that we were going to go overseas. They didn't tell us where we were going to go until we got on the airplane. And then when we got on the airplane, if I remember correctly, it was a few hours in, we found out we were going to the country of Jordan.
Wow.
And we ended up, I don't recall how many hours it took, but, you know, however long it took, and we landed at Al Hussein Air Force Base in Jordan. That's designated H-5 Jordan.
So did you fly directly from Georgia, our state of Georgia, to Jordan? Or did you let's say, stop in Germany or somewhere on the way?
Yeah, we stopped. I believe we stopped in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. I never got off the plane. I don't remember ever getting off the plane, though.
Wow.
Everywhere we stopped, it was for fuel, and then we left.
I see.
So
you landed in Jordan, and what's going through? Tell us, when was this? You know, you had mentioned being in Georgia for a couple months training. So are we now in March of 2003 now?
End of February.
End of February.
Yep, very end of February. Got to the country of Jordan. Very interesting place, beautiful country, middle of the desert. It was a Jordanian military base that we landed on. It was just being built up. There was very little American presence when we got there. They had just started building Tent City.
Wow.
You had the Air Force there. You had the Army there. You had different other government agencies there. You had different services. If I remember correctly, the Australians were there. Jordanians, Australians, Air Force is there. Some Marines were there, and a few other people that, you know, who knows. You know, it was an invasion, so there's a lot of things going on, a lot of moving pieces at that point in time.
Right, Brian. So, I just have to interject for a second, if I could.
Of course.
By a little inner service humor here, because I was in the Air Force. Were the Air Force tents air conditioned by any chance? That's a little joke.
I'll be honest with you. In Jordan at the time, our tents were air conditioned.
Wow.
We were lucky because we're in Tent City on a base.
Okay, I see.
Now, outside of that environment, once I left Jordan, that didn't exist anymore.
Right.
If I remember correctly, when I was in the Iraqi desert next to the Air Force, they didn't have nothing either.
Oh, okay. Yeah, when you were mentioning Tent City, I was also thinking back to back the first Gulf War and Desert Shield, Desert Storm. How, you know, the Air Force was the recipient of some appropriate humor from some of the other services, appropriate ribbing, because at some point they got air conditioning for their tents. But so much for roughing it. But go ahead and continue. Continue telling us about, so you're in Jordan, and now we're getting towards the end of February 2003. What goes on with your unit?
You know, so the unit, there's a lot of controversy about National Guard being in combat and things of that nature. Weekend warriors, things, you know, and all the derogatory terms that go along with it. It's a very interesting story, and there's many books on it. One book that you can read about the Florida Army National Guard and the military is All Roads Lead to Baghdad. There's a big story about my unit, Charlie Company, 2nd and 124th, in that book. We're actually attached to ODA 571, 5th Group Special Forces. We had a few different missions. One of the missions was pilot recovery for a squadron of A-10s.
Wow.
We actually did part of the, you see, our first platoon operated and provided security for an EPW camp after the invasion. And then my platoon, second platoon, we were Quick Reaction Force, or QRF, during the invasion. And then our third platoon actually went to the border with 5th Group, ODA, Australians, and other people. A lot of the soldiers, they were in charge of digging down the berms to clear the way for all the gun trucks to go through. A mortar section picked up a defense, and other things. There's a really good video on it. There's a video floating around in night vision on it. But so we were pretty integral in the invasion through Jordan into Iraq as a National Guard unit, which is pretty interesting because a lot of people associate National Guard with weekend warriors and beer drinkers.
Right. Oh yeah. I mean, the military relied so heavily on the Guard and Reserve in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us, so why don't you take us to the point where, okay, now the invasion's just about to start and then it begins. What was that like? What was that experience like?
So that was a totally different experience than leaving Florida. The excitement turned into reality. And that was, you know, for myself, that's when reality really hit. You know, we did a lot of training in Jordan. We did a lot of preparation, and then we had this period of time where there was just nothing. You know, we still had PT, we still had things we had to do as soldiers, but we weren't training anymore for X amount of hours per day. We had time to think, we had downtime, and that's when things started to really hit home. Started thinking about my daughter, started to think about what life would be like for my daughter if I didn't make a home. Started thinking about, okay, well, if I did make a home and something happened to me, all those things go through your head. We watch so many movies and we have so many ideas of what war looks like. It really fills our head full of stuff, you know? So all those different variables ran through my head. You know, what if I'm a paraplegic? What if I'm brain dead, or how is this going to affect my family, or whatnot? You know, the excitement was still there, but there was definitely some reality that was taking place there. You know, as young soldiers back then, we were allowed to procure alcohol here and there, you know. And I'll be the first one to admit, I mean, drinking alcohol over there was great. Well, you know, until you got a little bit too tipsy. There was a lot of emotions flying when the alcohol started flowing. We actually had a few Desert Storm vets there, if I remember correctly, that were there to kind of take us along and give us some insight, you know, and let us know that the unit, not only the unit, but your buddies are there for you.
Yeah, that's good. So it was yeah. Definitely, as you were saying, the excitement was kind of changing to kind of a sobering acknowledgement of reality. Now you're really going to war, and you were thinking through all these different scenarios about what could happen. At that point now, this is March of 2003, the invasion is beginning. Did you all have any idea how long you were going to be over there at that point, or was it just kind of an open-ended thing?
It was open-ended. It was absolutely open-ended. We had no idea when we were going to be home.
I see. So yeah, you're no pretty idea. Much just there told was... you're going to be there, and you're going to be there as long as Uncle Sam needs you there, and you're just going to have to complete your mission and move forward. So okay, so
that's correct. Matter of fact, my platoon sergeant, who I have utmost respect for, he's a command sergeant major now, but I remember him saying, you know, the guys that went to World War II, they never knew when they were coming home, and they were there. Some of them were there for 4 years. And he was pretty much like, you can expect the same. We don't know what's going to take place. We don't know how serious it's going to be.
But this is the real deal, guys. We're going to war.
Yeah. Well, I could share a little perspective from when I was on active duty, which included Desert Shield, Desert Storm. You know, back in Vietnam, it was a big change from World War II. World War II was you're going with your unit, you're going to be there for the duration, however long it takes, all right? We won that war in 3.5 years. In Vietnam, it turned into you're going to be over there for 12 or 13 months, and you're coming home. Some people would volunteer for a second tour, but it was pretty much fixed. It was, as soon as you got over there, it was a countdown. You know, for most in the Army and the Air Force, it was 12 months. I think for the Marines, it was 13 months in Vietnam. But after that, you know, then it was no longer the same mindset, the same situation as in World War II. But then fast forward, you know, a little over 20 years to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and when they deployed in Desert Shield starting in August of 1990, you know, no one knew exactly if we were actually going to go to war, when war was going to start. There was a buildup. The war actually did start in January of 1991. But I know from, you know, being stateside at that time at a base where there was a lot, we deployed a lot of people, processed a lot of people, those questions, even before Christmas of 1990, which was, we don't know when the war is going to start, and the higher-ups were having to already start thinking about what's going to be the rotation. Is it going to be a one-year thing like in Vietnam? Was it going to be 6 months or 9 months? And then the war started. The war ended relatively quickly, and most of those folks started coming home, and then they started following on with 6 months or even three-month tours of duty over there as part of the post-war. But that's why I was wondering, you know, what were you all told? Okay, so the invasion begins. Tell us what it was like. And I understand then at some point you yourself were injured and you had to be evacuated out.
Right. Yeah, that was many months later. That was in September. You know, going back to the reality of things, really the real miss hit when my buddies left for the border of Iraq. That was the real hit. We call them LTVs, but all their douche and hats and LTVs were armored with sandbags as much as we could. You know, we started preparing the vehicles for heavy engagements. And that was kind of like, wow, this is, I got some friends that are getting ready to go do some stuff here. And I may not.
Brian, was that kind of an acknowledgement that maybe the vehicles weren't properly up armored as it later, you know, became a big issue? I mean,
Well, yeah, back then at the very beginning, we had Deucin Has, we had cargo Humvees. I don't think I ever seen anything that was up armored until probably the middle of the deployment when we got an up armored Humvee.
I see.
But yeah, there was nothing at the beginning that had any kind of significant armor on it. It was just, you know, plastic or plastic, aluminum, or sheet metal.
I see. That was a really controversial thing.
It was, you know, and you know, when you bring that up, we are very fortunate, and I really think this has to do with the units that we're attached to. But right before we left for Iraq, we got the Interceptor body armors. That's a ceramic plate body armor. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the other units had the old steel plates or flak jackets. A lot of units had flak jackets still.
Wow.
They had no armor.
Wow. So, Brian, tell us about, you know, the war has begun. Take us through that up to the point in September when you were injured, and then you left Iraq. What was that like? What was that period of time?
So we ended up my specific after the invasion took place, our first platoon and our second platoon came back to Jordan. We were reconsolidated as a company. We all went to the central western part of Iraq. It was a little air base called H1. I don't recall the town that it was nearby, but it was a little airfield. At the end of the airfield, there was an EPW camp. That's where our first platoon provided security and took place in all the affairs at the EPW camp. My platoon, the platoon that I was in, we had observational posts around the airfield. And then we had another platoon that did a lot of patrolling and things of that nature around the OPs. We were there for about a month. Didn't really see too much. Had a lot of interaction with Bedouins. Unfortunately, I lost a friend. We did have a casualty during that process. Unfortunately, one of the Humvees, the only up-armored Humvee that I had seen at the time, it flipped in the desert.
Oh wow!
Unfortunately, the young man didn't make it. That Humvee rolled over on. That was another wake up call. That things are real. But so we spent about a month and a half out in the desert. I lived in the ground. We had our rucksack. We had our poncho liners and our ponchos and. We had GP medium set up in the rear where our supply section was, but no, you know, no AC, no heat. We did have bottled water at the time that the Air Force threw in for us. But it was, you know, we were roughing it as much as you could possibly rough it.
Right.
Once that mission was over, we consolidated again, went back to Jordan, went back to H5, and then went to Baghdad. And that's when pretty much the whole dynamic of the deployment changed.
And how did it change?
Up until that point, well, it changed because we were in Baghdad. There's a lot of stuff going on in Baghdad. There's a lot of moving pieces in Baghdad. Even though, you know, when we got there, it was in, I'd say, April, May. I would say it would have been May 2003. You know, the Green Zone was operating. You had shuttles that run from different compounds from chow halls, and you have reporters walking around, you had contractors and things of that nature. It was somewhat surreal, to be honest with you, because you would hear firefights going on, you know, and there would be people walking around like there's nothing going on.
Wow.
It was really interesting. I could remember taking a shuttle from the Baghdad Convention Center, where we were providing security for during our missions, into one of the palaces, one of the Saddam's own palaces, the Yi Chow. And it was, I don't want to say you're not on guard, because you're always on guard. But it wasn't what I would have thought war would have been like at that specific period in time. There was moments that it was a little surreal. There was definitely some complacency there. There was definitely some thought that a lot of the insurgents or a lot of the active fighting was subsided for a little bit of time. We all know by history that wasn't the case. I mean, they were lying and waiting. So, but we patrolled the Tigris River. We patrolled all over Baghdad. I went from down Route Tampa from the convention center down to the Baghdad airport, went to BIAP, all over the place, all over Iraq.
Wow.
So, and then we did have an unfortunate combat loss. One of my friends, you know, I'm going to call him a friend. I mean, he was in a different platoon. It's funny how things work in the military. You know, your real buddies, the guys that you're really friends with, are usually the guys in your squad, you know,
right,
or your platoon, you know, and those are the guys you live with, you patrol with, you sleep with, things of that nature. You know, this other young man, Jeffrey Warshow, he was in another platoon. I knew him. We talked, we had conversations, things of that nature, but, unfortunately, he lost his life. And that was rough. You know, we did a lot of stuff up until that point. and you kind of get a sense of, I don't want to say that you're, you know, you're bulletproof or anything like that, but, you know, we had been shot at by that point. We had patrolled. We were in Baghdad. You know, we were walking tall.
Right.
And it's just unfortunate. It's very unfortunate what took place. And that really changed the dynamic of the unit and how serious we took things. And our composure changed and our posture changed. We all had, I feel, you know, I can say for myself, I can't speak for other people. You know, you're walking tall, you know. I made it through the invasion of Iraq. And then Baghdad, I walked around Baghdad. I patrolled the Tigris River. I'm kind of a badass.
Right.
You know, then you lose a buddy. And it humbles you a little bit. And it makes you think a little bit more about how complacent you've gotten and paying attention to things. That was a pretty tough one. That's not something that I would even, I will tell you, and a lot of people would yell at me for this, but, you know, even enemy soldiers, you know, they have friends and family. Nobody wants to lose a loved one, you know.
Right.
When things like that take place, somebody has an emotional response to it. And it's, you know, it's hard. It is. It's hard. So.
Right.
So, you know, following those, following that unfortunate incident, you know, a lot of us, we pulled a lot of security in the convention center where we're at. General Sanchez came and did his briefings. Paul Bremerman came and did his briefings. The Iraqi public had never been in their own convention center before.
Wow.
It was controlled by the Ba'ath Party. And once things were loosely stabilized, you know, they were allowed to come in and actually look at their convention center, which was absolutely beautiful. You know, the architecture in Baghdad was breathtaking. You know, so we were very busy. We were very busy doing force protection. And, you know, there was a lot of media around. We had to watch our P's and Q's. Out of brass.
Well, Brian, let me. I don't mean to interrupt, but let me ask you too, if we could tell us about. You know, you were. I understand you were injured. Then you were evacuated, and later you retrained to serve as a crew chief on medevac choppers.
Right.
If you could tell us about that, and then tell us about your service in Iraq in a few minutes, because then I'd like to turn it over to Richard Hurley, who has questions about the subject. I know you have a lot of additional expertise, which is the impact of all this, of the war on you, the transition back to civilian life. Richard has a lot of questions on that. But before turning it over to Richard, if you could just tell us about your retraining, going to Afghanistan, to kind of give our audience a full sense of your service.
Right, of course. So make a long story short, speed things up a little bit. I wasn't injured during a combat scenario. I busted my ankle really bad. I fractured my tibia right below my knee. And I had to be medevaced out. I wish I could say it was a war story, but it wasn't. I was medevaced out of Baghdad and went to Longstuhl, Germany. They fixed me up, went to Fort Gordon. I ended up, I was released from medical whole battalion at Fort Stewart, Georgia. The things that took place when I came home, that's where pretty much the story begins as far as where I'm at today. You know, I just explained everything that took place in Iraq, and for the average, for somebody that's listening that's never been in combat, or somebody that has been in combat, you know, there's a lot of fun times. There's a lot of things that happened that were really enjoyable, and still to this day, I really enjoyed all my experiences when I was overseas. But there's other things that took place when I came home, And I really didn't understand until now what was going on. But I had time to reflect. You know, I had time to go through every single thing that we did over there. And when you start thinking about the possibilities of what could have happened, or if this should have happened, did I do the right thing, or things of that nature, that stuff really weighs on you. When I came home, being that I was a National Guardsman, I went back home. I went back to my job after I was released. I didn't have any buddies. I didn't really have any support from the military. So I was kind of left to deal with things on my own. And, you know, there's guys that are so much worse off than I am, and I recognize that. But there's things that take place when you feel for your life for a certain amount of time, that has a big play in your nervous system and your mental health. And I took a lot of stuff for granted when I was over there. And I came home and it really impacted me. I'm not going to say that I'm not strong, but, you know, it's definitely something that impacted me when I got home. I really had to work through some things. One of the big things that, you know, it's not the military, but military culture, you drink a lot. You know, alcohol is definitely one of those things that you use to relieve stress and aggravation, and you have fun and you do stupid things. That's what young soldiers do. I use it in excess. One of the ways I used to deal with things, I used to drink. I used to have pretty big parties and stuff like that, and I was trying to emulate the interactions that I had with my buddies, my Army buddies. And that was the big thing. That's what I've learned now, that I understand what I was doing back then. I was trying to emulate what I was doing with my Army buddies, because I was lonely. They weren't here. They weren't there anymore.
I see.
I couldn't roll over. I couldn't roll over and touch somebody that was next to me. You know, and there was a lot of guilt and shame because I did leave Iraq before my unit did because of an injury. Nobody can blame anybody for anything. It was an injury.
Right.
You know.
Now, Brian, you retrained from the infantry after your injury to serve in the Black Hawk medical evacuation helicopter you went to Iraq. If you could just briefly give us an idea of what it was like, the tough experiences you had in Afghanistan. Then I'm going to turn it over to Richard Hurley, who's going to ask you about, you know, when you came home from Afghanistan, bringing you up to your work now for veterans. So
tell us
what it was like in Afghanistan flying in medevac helicopters.
Iraq and Afghanistan were two totally different experiences. Afghanistan was blood and guts every single mission. That was a big difference. Iraq, we would patrol. Nothing would happen. We'd get shot at here and there. But it wasn't an intense, traumatic situation every single mission. Even when you're off, when you're not flying, you're still supporting a medevac unit. So you're still inundated with blood and guts, trauma, with people dying, things of that nature. And unfortunately, you know, it's a different world. It's a different war. It's not World War II anymore, where there's mines and soldiers with uniforms and things of that nature. You know, children and women get involved in what's going on today. And, you know, unfortunately, my specific unit, we dealt with a lot of kids at the time. That, for me, that's a very interpersonal issue. I have three daughters now and a granddaughter. Kids, that's my thing. That's my breaking point. That was probably the hardest thing it was to deal with for me, was dealing with kids that were either shot or blown up. We picked up a young man that had his testicles cut off because he pissed his dad off. Okay, you deal with stuff like that over there. You know, so that's the difference. Afghanistan was a totally different experience than Iraq. I think Iraq really, Iraq trained me to go to Afghanistan, in a sense.
Wow.
you know, and
I think, Brian, that gives us a pretty good sense. Just in the interest of the time we have tonight, let me turn it over to Richard Hurley, because Richard wanted to focus, to talk to you about, you know, now you're coming home from Afghanistan, what you're going through. So, Richard, over to you.
Yeah, how you doing, Brian?
Hey, Richard, how you doing tonight?
You know, I've been listening to your story, and it's quite a story that you went through and the experience you went through. And one of the things that struck me is, you know, you talk about the kind of the excitement, romanticism of going off to war, and you refer to a couple of shows, Rat Patrol, and I remember Rat Patrol, I love that show. And what you kind of expected it was going to be like. And then when you got over there, you had some experiences that kind of confirmed kind of the excitement of it all. But clearly, you went through a lot of traumatic stuff, which caused you to, drink excessively alcohol, PTSD. So we've got, you know, we have parents and young people listening to this show. Can you kind of put in perspective the before the romanticism and then really what it's all about? And when you look at it today, would you do it all over again? And if you would, what would you have done differently now that you're an older guy, middle-aged guy, and looking back on your experience?
So to answer that, the first thing I would say, especially to any young men that are listening today that have future plans of going to the military, probably the best thing I've ever done in my life. I've learned more and I've grown more personally than I think I would have ever if I hadn't gone to the military, including my deployments. I think they've built character in me. You know, what we see on TV, even the shows that are the movies that proclaim that they're as accurate as they possibly can be, they don't really invoke the emotion that you go through when you're in the moment, when you're in that process of doing what you're doing. There's a lot of downtime when you're in the military. There's a lot of time to think. There's a lot of time for what ifs. You know, there's a lot of things that people don't see when they're watching those movies. You know, they don't see the guy that gives his all 150%, but because he's not part of the clique, he's peered out. You know, or the guy that, you know, he's faithful to his wife and he's paying his mortgage and he's busting his ass and he's over in Iraq and Afghanistan and he gets a Dear John letter. You know, and then, you know, then that takes a huge toll, not only him, but the entire unit. Because now he's not as effective as he was before. You know, movies don't show that stuff. They can't invoke the emotions that we feel. I think the population that can relate closest to us, you know, would be law enforcement. You know, those guys, they go out every night. You know, their families know that, you know, if something goes wrong, this could be the night that daddy doesn't come home, or my husband doesn't come home, or my wife doesn't come home. You know, those emotions are are there, and they're concrete. They don't go away. They're always in the front of your mind. They're never in the back of your mind. I got people that always say, bury your emotions. That's kind of how we deal with it. You know, you internalize everything, and then you externalize all the anger on the enemy or whatnot. But, you know, bury your emotions. Don't think about it. Don't let your mind go there. You know, there's only so much your body can take and your mind can take before it's full. You know, and I tell you, war looks great on TV. It looks fun. You know, there's a lot of camaraderie involved. You know, there's esprit de corps. You're winning. You know, and everything that goes along with it, you know. But I tell you, you know, when it's 120 degrees outside and you're walking around a town for 6 hours or 5 hours or however long you're walking around with 50, 60 pounds of gear on you and you're getting shot at. That's the thing that people don't see. They don't understand that. They can watch it on TV, but there's a disconnect.
Brian, let me move it along because we're going to be running out of time.
Yeah, of course.
You know, again, you're kind of, I understand where you're going, but, you know, what David and I do in terms of representing veterans and what you've been seeing working with veterans through the PTSD programs that you have, you know, so many of these people come home and they're damaged goods.
Yes, they are.
They're so damaged that they can't function. Literally cannot function in civilian life. And yet when they left with this romantic idea of war is going to be great, and then they come home and they're a shell of the person. I mean, that's what I'm really kind of pointing to. I mean, I need to, you know, war is hell. War is horrific.
War is hell.
And painting a romantic idea about it, I think is personally, I don't think it's a good thing to do, because I don't think we're letting an 18-year-old boy or girl who's just getting out of high school understand that this experience may affect their life for the rest of their life and affect their family for the rest of their life. So, you know, that's what I'm kind of focusing on. Which, you know, I never served. My father was in the Marines, but that wasn't part of my life. In fact, I was anti-service. I grew up in the post-Vietnam era as a kid. I watched it on TV, and I was anti-war. There was nothing romanticizing nothing romantic about it. So, you know, coming home now you're dealing with transitioning into civilian life. How did you talked about drinking, but how have you now, in your opinion, successfully transitioned into civilian life that you can now help other veterans who are damaged goods? Tell us about that.
So when I came from Afghanistan, I knew right away that I needed help. I knew in my soul that I needed help. I was extremely nervous. I couldn't sleep. I was on edge. Pretty much all the symptoms of PTSD that you could possibly think of. I immediately went to the VA, and that was the best thing I can do, the best thing I did, because I needed to talk to somebody that could understand what I was going through. And, you know, it took some time to open up to the person I was dealing with at the VA, though. Veterans have an issue talking to civilians that haven't been in the service and stuff like that, so it did take some time, but I had no emotion. I mean, I was to deal with the things that I dealt with in Afghanistan. I had to shut off my emotions because I'm very empathic. I have a lot of empathy, especially for children and stuff like that. So I had to shut my emotions off to function. I was a leader. I'm an NCO. I couldn't show my soldiers that I was emotionally involved in what was taking place. And my family knew it. My wife knew it. And I was not the person that left when I came home. It ended my marriage and many friendships. Was out of control. I was self-destructive. It's self-destructive. It was suicidal. I didn't want to acknowledge the fact that I had lost control of what was going on with myself. But the first step that I had to do, and it didn't take anybody telling me, even though my family was telling me, I had to come to the own conclusion, my own conclusion, that I was going through something I couldn't control, that I needed help. I had to reach out for that help. And when I reached out for the help, I made a personal obligation that I was going to do what I can do, not only for me, but to better the quality of life for my family too. That's by the first thing. You know, there's other places than the VA. There's the vet center. But if anybody out there is going through anything, and they can't sleep, they're drinking, their marriage is failing, they're afraid to be around their kids because they're afraid they're going to hurt them, or because they're over aggressive. Those are things that people need to think about. Like, you know, it might be time to talk to somebody, and don't worry about being labeled or labeling or diagnosis. You know, those things are that's a bygone era. You know, people need to think about their future. You know, Vietnam vets and Korean War vets and World War II vets, those guys are still at the VA, and they're just now getting treatment for PTSD.
Brian, if I could just interrupt, I'm sorry, Richard, because we've just got about 5 minutes left. But, Brian, I wanted you to really talk about your website, PTSDRecoveryProgram.com, and your work now as a certified recovery peer specialist. Could you tell us really what's that about, and just give us a quick overview of what our listeners can find on that just extraordinary website?
Okay, thank you. So the PTSDRecovery.com it's a website that guys can go to when it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and they could just surf. They could fish the website. They could look at things. There's a lot of resources on there. There's a lot of links that go right directly to the VA. So it's empirical research. It's not by myself or somebody else just writing stuff on a board. It's actual scientific research. And then there's my own story on there. There's legal resources on there. There's here in Tampa Bay, there's a few mental health providers that are veterans themselves that have private practices that offer mental health services. There's other resources on there, excuse me, for home loans and things of that nature. But I put that website together so guys can go on a website that's kind of, it has everything in one place, or it has a link to go, you know, to somewhere that pertains to whatever situation they're going through. It's got things about PTSD, alcoholism, anger management, red flags, what it looks like. You know, if you're displaying symptoms of PTSD or displaying symptoms of rage and things of that nature. As far as my certified peer specialist certification, I spent about 700 hours at the VA getting certified to become a certified peer specialist. I'm certified in the state of Florida to mentor vets with PTSD, substance abuse, anger management. I do it for free. I have no problems talking to somebody and being there. I'm not a clinician, so that means I don't diagnose. I don't offer expert medical advice. But what I can do is I could share my story, and I can help you brainstorm, and I can help you see the things that you're not seeing. One of the things I really believe in is getting your family involved. This needs to be a family event, not just one person. The veteran should never be working on this alone. It's a family unit. It's a cohesive unit. And the family, if the veteran gets better, then the whole family gets better.
That's a great point, Brian. And in the interest of, unfortunately, we're about, just got about a minute left. So again, for our listeners, Brian's website is PTSDRecoveryProgram.com. And then Brian, real quick, tell us quickly about your own personal goals and your plans for further work for veterans.
You know, right now I'm at St. Leo University. I'm in my infancy of my master's program for psychology. I have a goal to get my LMHC, licensed mental health counselor. And then I plan to open my own clinic. I have a medical protocol that I use that I think is very good for veterans and their families. I do have a FundMe account. The FundMe account is, I call my five-year plan. I have 5 years to raise enough money to own a clinic. That's honestly nothing like anybody has. And it immerses not only the veteran and the family into military culture. It's more of an educational program. Instead of sitting in front of somebody and
having them tell you about their problems, things of that nature. It's more about military indoctrination and how that military indoctrination affects you as a person. And
that's great, Brian. I'm sorry to cut you off, but for our listeners' benefit, Brian's two websites, their links are on our show website, which is bbsradio.com/theveteransnewshour. His website, ptsdrecoveryprogram.com, and then his GoFundMe.com website. The link is on our show website. We're out of time, unfortunately, tonight. Brian, I'd like to thank Brian Ellis for being on our show. Thank you so much, Brian. Maybe we can have you back again so you can share more of your insights and keep us posted on your progress. Does that sound like a plan?
Oh, I'd love to.
Very good. Well, thanks. So we're about out of time for tonight.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Thank Brian Ellis for being our guest. I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We'll be back here next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope everyone has a great week. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.